On this week's 51%, November's presidential election is right around the corner. How's everyone doing? We speak with psychology professor Siobhan D. Newport about the impacts of election anxiety.
On days when people anticipate that they're going to have something stressful regarding the election happen tomorrow, there's same day, like right now, consequences for their emotional and physical health.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. The presidential election is just around the corner now, on November 5th. Voters will choose between Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris and Republican former President Donald Trump. And depending on when and where you're listening, early voting is already underway. How is everyone feeling? If you're dreading the last days of the race or election day itself, you're not alone. The latest Stress in America survey by the American Psychological Association identified, quote, the future of the nation as the most common subject stressing Americans out, followed by the economy and specifically the presidential race. The term election anxiety seems to pop up nearly every election now, and it doesn't necessarily resolve when the polls close. For starters, we don't know yet if the race will actually be decided on election day, and Trump famously challenged the election results repeatedly when he lost to President Joe Biden in 2020. So we've got a ways to go, and it's a good idea to start taking care of yourself. Our main guest today is Siobhan D. Newport, a psychology professor at North Carolina State University who has been studying election anxiety and coping strategies since 2016.
We were collecting data from our participants. We were asking them every day to report on the stress in their lives and their health and their well-being. And they were doing this for a series of 8 consecutive days. And we were in the field on the date of the election in 2016. And we didn't realize it was an opportunity at the time to look at how people might respond to the stressors in their own lives that were unrelated to politics or the election. And we saw that in the days immediately after the presidential election, that people's emotional responses, the emotional consequences of their own stressors were much stronger compared to the days that they had before the election. So it really got us thinking about elections and their predictable rhythm, the fact that we have national elections every 2 years, whether it be presidential or midterm, thinking about it as an opportunity to really understand how does this impact people's day-to-day functioning and their well-being. So we've tried to be very intentional about it since then. We ask people to report on their anticipation or their forecast of what they think they would experience regarding the election process as we near the election. So we ask people to make an evaluation of how likely they think it would be that they would experience a stressor about the election tomorrow. So we ask them to restrict their forecast to just one day forward. And then we also evaluate their emotional health, their physical health, their memory functioning. And we're really interested in how these things play together over time. We've also gotten into thinking about ways to really probe for the kinds of coping strategies that people are using to manage the stress that's associated with elections.
Are you able to get a sense of, I guess, why elections make us feel so stressed?
I think the reason why is really interesting, and it might be unique to each person. What we try to do in our studies, the way we have them set up, by asking people to repeatedly give us access to their experiences and their information over a series of consecutive days, is that we can compare one person's day to their own different kind of day. So we're not necessarily focusing a lot on how people are different from each other. We know that those differences between people do matter, but we really are able to probe for what is it about the changing days that people are experiencing that might be important for their approach to stress and then their response to stress. And so one way that we think about this is by asking people to kind of mentally time travel into the future and predict what kinds of stressors they might have about the election. And again, those could be specific to each person or to each kind of day. So the nice thing is that we can ask them to make that evaluation, and then we can follow up and ask them what they might be doing to cope with that potential future stressor.
I definitely want to hear some of those coping strategies too, but before we get there, how does this stress end up impacting us?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Our work, we've shown across several studies that on days when people anticipate that they're going to have something stressful regarding the election happen tomorrow, that there's same day, like right now, consequences for their emotional and physical health. So if I think that I'm going to have something stressful regarding the election happen tomorrow, I could expect that my negative mood, my bad mood would be higher today. And that I might rate my physical health as being poor compared to days when I don't think I'm going to have something stressful happen regarding the election. So the consequences are pretty immediate. They're felt the same day. And so we've connected it both to emotional and physical health so far.
And so what kinds of coping strategies do you see people turning to?
Yeah, I think when it comes to coping, I have found consistently across my career, it's really important that when someone is confronted with a stressor, whether it be in the future or in the past, that it's ideal to be able to match the coping strategy to the demands of that stressor. And so that may look different for each person. In this particular study, where we were looking at anticipating election-related stressors the next day, we found that on days when people could increase their use of problem analysis as a form of coping, that that was the most beneficial in preserving their physical health. They didn't experience the same decrease in physical health ratings that days with less problem analysis were associated with. So, problem analysis is kind of a broad term that captures, I kind of like to think of it as mental engagement with a problem or with a stressor. Some examples would be things like you would acknowledge that you would be thinking about why the stressor is happening, or you would work to try to understand why there is a stressor or why there is a problem. So it reflects this idea that you're thinking about it, you're pausing, maybe trying to really understand possibly someone else's perspective or another viewpoint, but there's no expectation that you would actually find a solution. Just doing the mental work of thinking about it, trying to understand the problem is what we found was really helpful for preserving physical health.
That's really interesting. A lot of the advice that I read and hear also mentions, reducing your news consumption or staying off social media. Do you find that helps people as well?
Yeah, that's interesting. And in this particular study, we didn't find evidence for that. But anecdotally, you could imagine if someone is aware that their exposure to social media is creating negative consequences for them, that it would be ideal to reduce or eliminate that exposure. So, in order to try to preserve mental well-being. So, you can see that avoidance certainly can be one strategy. If, in terms of the anticipation of election-related stressors the next day, we didn't find any evidence of things like avoidance. But I think, again, when people are evaluating the kinds of stress that they're experiencing in their lives, sometimes avoidance is the best option if that is the best strategy that matches the demand of the situation. And avoidance tends to be ideal if people believe that they don't have a lot of control over the situation. Trying to engage in something that feels futile or that you don't feel like you'll be able to effectively meet a goal, is one of the hallmarks when avoidance is actually the most useful strategy.
I think that's an interesting way of putting it, because I always wonder when people suggest unplugging, like, how do we have an engaged and informed public then? If we're all not listening in order to protect our own mental health, how are we supposed to move forward as a nation? So, you kind of want to stay informed, but it's also stressful at the same time. I think it's interesting to think of it, though, in a way that's like, well, maybe the people who are avoiding it already have a sense that they can't do anything to change it anyways.
Or in terms of thinking about elections specifically, this idea of problem analysis really is engaging with the ideas. It's engaging on your own terms. It's trying to find a understanding of why the problem is there, how it arose, what is the source of the stressor, why does it exist? So you could imagine actively engaging or taking some agency in trying to engage with an election-related issue that might be stressful could be one way of becoming very informed. And in this case, we found in this study, it was really helpful as a coping strategy as well.
If you don't have a whole lot of experience doing that kind of like introspective questioning or problem analysis, I guess, do you have any tips for those just starting out?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. We should not expect to be perfect at anything the first time, right? So, what we did with our participants was ask them over 30 consecutive days how they were managing and how they were using these coping strategies. On days when people were able to increase their problem analysis, so if I did more problem analysis today than I did yesterday, that's great. There are physical benefits to that increase in myself. It doesn't matter that I might be not doing as great as the next person. What matters is that I was able to improve compared to myself. And so that suggests there's some practice, keeping at it, trying, and really assessing what is working for you. And so if you're able to continue mentally engaging, trying to find the source of the issue to really understand it, that mental engagement we found was really helpful in trying to mitigate or offset the negative consequences of anticipating the election-related stress.
And when it comes to after election day, how might this care look a little bit different?
Yeah, when results are out, I mean, there's less uncertainty, certainly. And we know that uncertainty is very strongly associated with increased feelings of stress. So after the election has, or after the results have been determined, then there's more certainty. It can still be stressful. And in one study, we were evaluating people's reports of their core beliefs. These are the ways in which people believe that they fit in the world and how they understand the structure of the systems of the world. And we saw that people's core beliefs really were disrupted in the days after the 2018 US midterm election. And so we connected that disruption in their core beliefs to decreased feelings of life satisfaction, changes in their mood on a daily basis. And this was right after the election. And then we followed them 40 days later. So this would be in December of 2018. And those same people who had the biggest shock to their systems, who had this disruption in their core beliefs, they were the ones who actually bounced back the most. They were the ones who reported higher life satisfaction, better emotional functioning. So even if you feel like in the days after the election or after the results are announced, that there's this feeling that your sense of self or how you fit in the world or how the world operates has been shaken in some way, there's a value in letting time pass and continuing to process, because those feelings of disruption tend to be associated with really good outcomes as time passes.
A lot of what we've talked about so far has been more personal and introspective, but are there ways that we can look out for each other emotionally around Election Day?
Yeah, good, strong, supportive relationships are great regardless of the kind of stress. So, yes, the extent to which people can lean on their support networks, and be a supportive person in one's network is really useful as well. We didn't evaluate this specifically in our study, but I could imagine ways in which problem analysis could be collaborative, in safe spaces where people are willing to engage in discussions about problems or topics. You could imagine going through these questions and really trying to understand, like, how did we get to this particular problem or this particular stressor, and kind of see what other people might be processing or suggesting. So again, the extent to which that is a useful, constructive, helpful kind of conversation, I could imagine there may be benefits to doing this collaboratively.
Siobhan D. Neupert is a professor of psychology at North Carolina State University, researching election anxiety and the different coping skills that people use. You can learn more about her work at ncsu.edu. Our next guests are the founders of Fresh Starts Registry, a registry platform for those navigating divorce and other major life changes. And that, I think, is an interesting topic in and of itself. But for the last few months, the website has had a dual mission of reminding women to use their vote.
It has been a wild few days. Literally started a national conversation about voting. And who knew that that was going to happen on a random August day? Anyway, couple reminders. Number one,
that's Olivia Dreisen Howell, who founded Fresh Starts Registry with her sister, Genevieve Dreisen. Their new Vote Without Fear campaign, going viral on social media, covers basic information like, can I bring my kids with me to vote? Can I vote across party lines? And importantly, can my partner figure out who I voted for? This is all stuff that a lot of us might feel is common sense, but if you're in a controlling relationship or experiencing domestic violence, it might be a real concern. Howell says the Vote Without Fear campaign tries to answer a string of questions she got from women when she first posted about the issue on Instagram over the summer. I spoke with Howell and Dreisen about the campaign. Just a heads up to our listeners, this conversation does lightly touch on domestic violence.
I was thinking a lot about specifically when Harris, you know, decided to run after Biden stepped down. And we were pretty, I wouldn't say politically active, but we were very aware of what would happen in 2016. And so, you know, I was thinking a lot about the fact that there was a lot of shame around supporting our first female president, candidate for president. Yeah.
Yeah, Hillary.
And, right. And I didn't want people to feel that same shame now, especially when she was incredibly qualified to run for president. And so I put up an Instagram story on my personal Instagram account, which only has like 3,000 people. So it's not huge, but I have a very, very loyal community over there. And I said, just a friendly reminder, you don't have to tell anybody who you voted for. And they, you know, that was pretty much it. And I went and take a shower. I came back and I had a bunch of DMs from women specifically. And a couple of those questions were, can I vote across party lines in a general presidential election? I'm a registered whatever. Can I vote for the other side? And then one of the questions was, can anybody find out who I voted for? Can my husband find out who I voted for? So I said to Jenny, do you think anybody can see, you know, you can know who you voted for? And we were like, well, there's got to be a website that answers this easily.
Yeah. Olivia is about 2.5 years older than me. And sometimes that age gap feels very large. And I kind of rolled my eyes at her and I was like, of course there's someplace that has all this information, you know, boomer. And we went to go look it up and we were really surprised that like the questions that we were asking, the very particular questions, which were, was, can you vote across party lines? What information of yours is public about voting, and will anyone ever find out who you voted for, or is your vote basically secret or private? Mm-hmm. And we couldn't find one place that had all of those answers.
Yeah, so we did a lot of, we basically pushed all of our work aside that day. We did a lot of research and we thought, well, let's answer these basic questions with the information we found. And before we published this, I sent it to a friend of mine who works for a governor and he's one of their directors. And I said, hey, can you just check this information before we make it public? And he said, yes, this is all basic voting information. There's nothing here that is new or provocative, right? It was all just very basic voting information. So I have, at the time I had about 10,000 Twitter followers and again, a pretty loyal following over there. And so I tweeted and the only thing I changed in my tweet was I put this question. I said, we've been getting a lot of questions from people. And this question, can my husband find out who I voted for? And then I literally copied and pasted the blog post into the tweet. And it took off like wildfire. Immediately, some big people retweeted it. Busy Phillips, Shannon Watts. But what was really, really fascinating to us was that people were acting like they'd never heard this information before and that there was this conversation that really started to come to light that women are afraid to tell their husbands who they're voting for and daughters are afraid to tell their fathers and pastors are telling their congregations who to vote for. And it was like this storm just erupted of all this truth coming out.
So you've got this one-stop shop now for questions like, can you vote across party lines? Which, spoiler, you can. But, you know, you also answer questions like, can you take your kids to the polls? And I feel like the answer to that is also pretty clearly yes, but as someone who doesn't have kids, I don't know for sure. So what should you keep in mind when you're voting with children in tow?
So we always want to say at the top that this is not legal advice and we are not your state electorate board. So you should always contact your state electorate board if you have questions. But generally, you can bring anyone under the age of 18 years into the voting booth with you. That's considered a child. It does differ state by state, how many or county by county too, how many children. And we always want to let people know, like, it's confusing because it's meant to be confusing. Like, a lot of these laws are meant to confuse you and sort of catch you up. And, you know, we want people to be empowered in their voting. We came from a family of voters. It never occurred to us not to vote. And we've always been encouraged to ask questions. But a lot of people are shamed for it. We saw that in the response. A lot of the responses to Olivia's initial tweet were like, if you don't know this information, you shouldn't be allowed to vote. And then that sort of led into repeal the 19th Amendment, which was a whole other interesting conversation. But so we want people to not be afraid to ask these questions. We're a safe place to ask questions. So yeah, questions like, can I bring my kid to vote with me? Because a lot of women, if you're going to try to vote alone, you're going to have your baby with you. So it does differ state by state how many kids you can bring into the voting booth, but you can definitely bring anybody under 18 years old into the voting booth with you.
Okay, so now the big question, I guess, is your vote secret or are there ways someone can find out who you voted for?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. So when we say, you know, that somebody can't find out who you voted for unless you tell them, we're talking about voting in a very specific way sometimes, right, for most people. So when you go in person to the voting location and you by yourself go into the booth, and I say by yourself because some states do allow husbands and wives to go into the booth together, if both parties consent, which leads to a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. If you go into the booth by yourself and you cast your vote, there's no recorded registry of who mm-hmm. you voted for. Your voter registration information may be public, right? So in some states, like in New York where I am, you have to affiliate with a party in order to vote in primaries. So I'm a recorded Democrat, right? And so that information is public. Your address may be public, but who you voted
that,
for.
And that you voted is public.
And that you voted is public,
yes,
right?
But who you voted for is not.
Who you voted for is not public. What we have learned is that in some states, they are not as strict per se with the voting regulations. So they have tables that people can vote at without dividers between them. Then there is the conversation of mail-in voting, which can be very tricky when you are maybe living in a home with somebody who wants to coerce or manipulate you into voting a specific way. We got a lot of questions about that, and to which we say there is no good answer. I'm sorry. I always just say try to take your mail-in ballot and mail and fill it out somewhere public. They do, a lot of states, if not all states, do check your signature to make sure that it is you. So, you know, I think that that's a positive. There are a lot of resources for domestic violence victims. I know the hotline has amazing resources. And there are ways that you can register to vote safely if you are a domestic violence survivor. So there are options. We always want to say that. But yeah, I mean, there's no registry or recording of who you voted for. So I think that that's, you know, very important because, again, what we've seen in a lot of my tweets is some women, I will say, whether they were raised in certain types of households or they marry a certain type of people, they will be told that their vote will be found out about. I just got into a Twitter discussion yesterday with somebody who was trying to prove that you could find out who somebody voted for. And luckily, a lot of people proved him false, which is true. But, you know, so I think it's important to just remember that there are caveats to all of these things. And so we're very careful with the way that we word everything. We don't say your vote is secret. We don't say your vote is private. We like to say who you voted for is not public information, because that is the truth. But sometimes there will be people who, if you're voting at home, will be looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is something that you could speak to specifically, but you know, if you're in a situation where there's domestic violence or control, you know, are there resources out there to help you put together a safe voting plan?
There's a lot of resources out there to help put together a voting plan. One of the things that we did, because one of the things that you might not know is that not all states allow you to have your cell phone out. And we want people to feel empowered in the voting process, is that we put together a worksheet to create a voting plan. And it has everything in it from where you're voting, when you're going to vote. Did you do a drive-by? Like, we suggest people to go do a drive-by of their voting location. You know, I know a lot of women are voting for the first time in this election, and they feel nervous about where to go. My sister is a nervous parker and a nervous person at new places. So she is somebody that likes to know what the parking situation is. So we recommend you do a drive-by. And then we have two pages where you can fill out your ballot information so that you can bring it in with you to the voting location. The thing that we always tell people is just to stay safe. Like, your safety is our number one priority, your number one priority. So whatever you have to do to stay safe is important. But also to check out early voting options, go when you can, and have your reasons of why you're doing that if you're ready, if somebody is prepared to question you. Oh, I just filled out my ballot because it was in my hands and I threw it in the mailbox, something like that. We always just say, live your truth and also stay safe.
Yeah, and I will add to two things, is that there is an address confidentiality program that the hotline can help you with, and that is for voter registration if you're a domestic violence survivor or just afraid of somebody finding your address. You can work with the hotline. And then also, we have a hotline, so it's your vote hotline. And if you call the hotline, we wanted a way that people could safely get voting information that's not tracked online, because if you go online, and also with Vote Without Fear, we have a quick exit on that website as well, because we understand that it might be something people don't want other people to know that they're looking at. If you call the It's Your Vote hotline, there are some tips on there about like what you could say, like, I was just, you know, going out anyway to run errands, drop my ballot off, you know, and some kind of easy little things you could use to make it more palatable for the people in your life, right, to understand what you were doing with voting. I will say too, the response to us reminding women, all women, whatever party affiliation you are, that it's your vote and you don't have to tell your husband who you voted for, deeply triggers a lot of people. And, you know, it leads to a whole other discussion of like, women are allowed to do things for themselves, right? And to make decisions for themselves. And I just think that, you know, the reaction that we got was really massive in both a negative and a positive way. And, you know, just that all women should remember, all people should remember, literally it's their vote. Every single American citizen has that right. And it's a constitutional right. And we're here just to kind of help support people through that process.
Well, Olivia and Jenny, thanks so much for joining us. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on Fresh Starts Registry because I think it's really interesting. Why have a registry for divorced people or just for different chapters in your life?
You know, Olivia and I think we underestimate the connection, the bridge between supporter and those who need support. And I think it can sometimes be a hard bridge to cross. We don't exactly always know what to say or what to do. And when I went through, I ended a 10-year relationship, we were engaged. And this was sort of the impetus of starting Fresh Starts. Olivia had that idea. She brought it to me. And then I ended my relationship. And I was alone in an apartment. And I had so many people reaching out asking how they could help. Can I build furniture? Can I break down boxes? What do you need? What do you need? What do you need? And my sister was like, that would be a really good moment for this registry idea, huh? So we started it, and 2 months later, it existed. But I think, you know, so often what we hear is like, well, you shouldn't have to buy people stuff. But when you love someone, you want to support them and you want to take care of them. And it goes underestimated how much looking around a new home and seeing things that people have cared for you and loved you and bought you and also built for you or helped you put together, all those things, how important it is. My sister and I were just in Disney for a week together, and we left, and I was the saddest I've ever been leaving my sister. And today I was the first day back at work, and I put on this sweater that she bought me when we were together, and I felt like I was getting a hug from my sister. And that is how people feel when they're getting items off their registry. They feel like they're getting a hug. They look at the coffee mugs in their, cabinet, and they go, that person loves me and they support me and they support my decisions. And that's what we want people to feel when they're going through a fresh start.
The other side of that that we love to talk about is the decision-making process. So, a registry is about so much more than the items on the registry. For so many people, whether you are going into your first apartment, whether you are getting a pet, which we have a pet registry, whether you are going through a breakup, it's the first time they're making decisions for themselves based on joy, based on all of these other, what colors do you love? What textures do you love? And so when we can make small decisions for ourselves, as silly as it sounds, like this is the shower curtain that I want for my new bathroom. When we see that shower curtain, it actually bolsters our decision-making confidence level so that we can say then, like, wow, I made a decision about the shower curtain. I can make a decision on a divorce lawyer, or I can call my ex-husband about this thing. So it, making small decisions snowballs to the big decisions. And we like to remind people it's not about the things. We actually don't call them gifts, we call them support. We like to say that the items on a registry are physical manifestations of the support that you can give to somebody. And like Jenny said, when you look around your house and you see the items that people, either built for you or the food that they gave you or that they got you from your registry, you can start to see your new life before you. And that's the most beautiful part, I think, of all of this.
Olivia Dreisen Howell and Genevieve Dreisen are the co-founders of Fresh Starts Registry, a registry and resources website for those going through divorce and other major life changes. We've specifically been talking about their Vote Without Fear campaign, reminding women that their vote is their vote. You can learn more at votewithoutfear.com, and their It's Your Vote hotline is available at 1-888-291-3027. Furthermore, if you or someone you love is experiencing domestic violence, help is available at the National Domestic Violence Hotline. That's 1-800-799-SAFE, or you can text START to 88788. Again, Election Day is November 5th. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcasts.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.